Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Brownlee with Talk. We're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, Council Fat Cats. A bombshell new report finds a record number of town hall staff are pocketing more than £150,000 a year. Refugee runaround. Suella Braverman's Rwandan homes for deported UK migrants are being sold to locals as the Conservative policy continues to flounder. And a top bank boss has moaned his company is being corporately bullied over its bizarre name change. Good evening, Britain. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. We've got a busy one for you tonight. Labour promised to tackle tax dodgers and use that money to fund the NHS. But will it work? Plus, sub-postmaster Alan Bates says those responsible for the post office scandal should be criminally charged. We'll get a reaction from Conservative MP Paul Scully, who has continually supported the victims. And you've heard of dating disasters. One man is suing more than 50 women for negative stories about their bad date with him. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. It's not me, by the way. Buckle up. Let's get this show on the road. Now, how about this? A shameful 188 council fat cats are earning more than £165,000 a year, making them richer than Rishi Sunak. And a record number are making over £150,000. There's at least 829 of them. The head of campaigns at the Taxpayers Alliance, which crunched these numbers, is Elliot Keck. He joins me now. Elliot, very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. This is quite staggering news, isn't it, given particularly the backdrop that we've got of so many councils claiming they've run out of money, they're having their heads to the bankruptcy court, they're going to have to put council tax up by as much as 20%, maybe more. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary how many of these people are getting paid this much money.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. And the average council tax increase for England was 5.1%, which is significantly above inflation for this year. And at the same time, I don't know about you, but for months and months and months, we've heard story after story from councils published right across the media saying that, quite frankly, they've got their backs against the wall and they're on the brink of bankruptcy. You mentioned the councils that have gone bankrupt, the Nottinghams and Birminghams of this world, but there are dozens others that have issued pretty shrill warnings, actually, about potential bankruptcy. And at the same time, the number who are receiving over £100,000, very handsome remuneration packages, has surged by over 350 in the last financial year.
And what do you think is the driving force for these extremely high wages? Because an awful lot of these people are not doing jobs which are particularly difficult. I mean, I'm under the impression that an awful lot of people, particularly in office jobs at the council, are indeed not even bothering to go into work. They're all working from home.
Well, it's really interesting. I think ultimately what it comes down to is if you give councils more money, they're going to employ more people on senior salaries. Yeah. And actually, over the last few years, we've seen council funding being restored to levels actually above what they were a few years ago, not just per person, but per person in real terms. And you've seen more money from governments, you've seen more money from council taxpayers, and you've seen more money from things like parking charges. Yeah. And actually, if you give councils more money, ultimately they're going to pay their staff more.
Yeah, absolutely right. And of course, everybody knows now, because I've been banging this drum for many years, a very long time, that something like 70 to 75% of your council tax money actually goes towards the salaries and the pensions of most of the people working in the council. And so the services that get pulled and get cancelled and get dropped are being done and cancelled on the wherewithal of people getting paid more.
Well, that's why we use remuneration and not salary, because salary just looks at your basic pay. It doesn't look at all the other things that you get when you work in the public sector. And in the public sector, you get pensions that you and I and most of the country can only dream of. And so that's why we do remuneration. That means salary, that means pension, and that means a number of other benefits that you get from that job. And I think it's really important that we look at it in the round, and that's how you get to some of these figures. £651,000 for one person who received a loss of office payment, a huge pension on top of their salary. And it's really important that we look at that as well.
And as far as the way that they're going forward, some of these councils, I mean, we did a story only yesterday saying that council sort of car parks and council parking bays are now bringing in something like £2 billion a year just in England alone. They're going to put those up. Some parking fees have gone up just today by as much as 60%. I was talking to people today who said that, you know, it used to be that you would pay and display a pound for an hour. You now have to get an app and it's gone up to £1.70 per hour. And so they're raking in money hand over fist. And yet they keep complaining that they're getting less and less from central government. I mean, is that plausible?
Well, yeah, up and down the country, you are seeing councils either increase their charges for normal services, things like collecting garden waste, or actually introduce charges where they didn't exist before. And on the other side, you are seeing them cut services. Let's say Greenwich Council, that are scrapping lollipop ladies, very much a beloved institution for the British public. And yet they've got over 40 people receiving over £100,000. And I think councils are going to have a difficult time over the next few weeks with these findings in our 17th Town Hall Rich List about how to justify these swinging cuts to services, these huge hikes to council tax, and yet the significant increases in the number of people receiving these very, very large pay packets.
Indeed. Elliot, thanks very much indeed. Elliot Keck there from the Taxpayers Alliance. I've got this here. Biggest bonus awarded to an employee of a council-owned body, £72,280. I'm delighted to say I'm joined now by writer and broadcaster Candice Holdsworth and barrister Stephen Barrett. Very good evening to both of you. I mean, there was a time when you got a job in the public sector because even though the wages were less than the private sector, the perks were very good,
yes.
The pension was pretty good, and they had pretty decent benefits for things like, you know, healthcare and things like holidays. But you've now got the best of both worlds working for the council because, one, you probably don't have to go to work at all. You can just work from home. And, two, you get a big salary in addition to everything else.
It's so true. That used to be the trade-off, so that's how you attracted good people.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't earn a high salary now, but you get an excellent pension contribution. I think what you still want to attract good people, but you have to be really realistic about how this revenue is raised. I mean, you're not a profit-generating business.
No.
It comes from taxpayers.
Right.
And taxpayers are under increasing pressure. And as we're seeing with lots of councils, the services are being cut, they're becoming lower quality, and the council tax is going up. So, I mean, it's really, really unfair. And I'm so glad we're having this conversation now about providing value to taxpayers.
And, Stephen, they continually blame the Tories, as it is their wont to do, I suppose, because that's what everybody does. But, you know, despite the fact that they're still raising more money from things like parking, from things like, you know, low emission zones and that sort of thing, and council tax, it seems extraordinary to me that it can't all be the fault of central government giving them less money, surely.
Well, that's true. And just to add into the mix there, there's one thing we forgot constitutionally, which plays quite an important role in public sector remuneration, which is the honours system.
Mm.
And the honour system is designed to reward people who go and work in the public sector and who take that pay cut for the public sector, which they are apparently no longer taking.
Right.
And that was structurally very important. It has eroded since the 90s. And do we pay as much attention to honours? You know, using people's first names seems to have taken that system away. Are people as respectful as they used to be? I mean, those are questions I raise. Why these jobs keep cropping up, by the way, Mike, and by the official civil service figures, the total civil service employment from 2022 to 2023 was $266 billion.
Mm.
And I don't believe that will be the actual number because it will be suppressed somehow because that's all that we do nowadays. But if you're going to look at these things, you're going to have to look at employment. Mm. And it is linked to law. So as law has bloated in complexity, you're getting people who can justify having a very high salary job just to deal with processing all of these rules.
Yes.
So the bureaucracy is rewarding itself by becoming more complicated, demanding therefore higher salaries to deal with the complication. Not necessarily anything anybody cares about.
Right.
I mean, there are lots of reports
and
paper.
I mean, we've got council elections coming up in May, which obviously we don't talk about because we're not really supposed to. But there will be councillors elected, there will be councillors unelected, there will be councillors that run and don't get in. But we're not really talking about them because what we are talking about are these kind of this new breed of sort of, you know, civic administrator, really. And I take your point, Stephen, that they are probably expert in some areas, but many of them are not. I mean, I remember working in Edinburgh back in sort of 2006, and the chief executive of Edinburgh City Council was on £500,000. And when I used to challenge them on it, because I had a radio show up there, they said, oh, well, we have to pay the commensurate rate. And I said, well, how is it? What job is commensurate? And they said, well, he's got a £40 billion budget. But, I mean, he wasn't qualified, really, to do anything.
No, and you've seen as well that they've made some absolutely terrible financial decisions that they're not qualified to make.
Right.
I mean, having investment arms, for instance. Right. There was Bournemouth Council, who recently spent, I think, nearly £2.5 million on some eco-office hub that hardly anyone's used.
Right.
I mean, they're never going to recoup those costs. It's not worth it. So, I mean, it's true. You need to raise that. What exactly is the expertise they have that justifies these enormous salaries? It just seems to me that, you know, they've said that costs are going up, but they are failing to manage their own costs. Mm. Because even Birmingham City Council, when it was facing that huge bill for the legal case that was brought against them, the equality pay, they still didn't reduce their costs.
No.
They still took on very expensive projects.
Right.
So there is a huge problem
there. And this is what I argue with people about all the time with the public sector, Stephen, where in a commercial organisation, you know, rather like looking at what we do here and what they do at the BBC, they have no concept of commercial capabilities and the need to actually cut your cloth because either there's a downturn in what you're getting back in or the revenues are falling. They have no concept of that.
Yes, and it's largely because it is consequence-free. But, I mean, I have a theory that if you're not actively fighting a human vice, it will be getting worse.
Yeah.
And we haven't looked at inefficiency and waste and bloat in the public sector for a very long time.
Mm.
And so has that, whilst we haven't been looking at it, been getting worse? I mean, how do we employ more people post-pandemic than we did pre-pandemic?
Yes.
Why?
I know. Well, we've now got 6 million people working in the public sector. That sort of covers basically all of it, including the NHS, which now accounts for a third of that, with 2 million alone. But look at the number of government advisers we've got, you know, which we didn't have 20, 30 years ago. Suddenly there's dozens of them, all being paid by the public purse, and they all think that they're doing a great job. But in fact, we could probably do without them, given the way the country's being run. I don't know who's advising the government, but I don't think they're worth paying, to be honest.
Yes, I think that seriously has to be looked at, and it seriously has to be considered, along with, you know, what many people think is a ballooning welfare bill as well. I just don't think the taxpayer, and I mean people I speak to, I don't think they've ever been under as much pressure as they are now.
Mm.
And these are people on decent incomes. And yet they say at the end of every month, I have nothing left, I cannot save.
Right.
And that's really shocking because
you're
seeing this huge gap opening up between the private sector and the public sector.
And I mean, we've seen some of these figures that have come out for remuneration and for you know, compensation for a loss of employment. But for an awful lot of people, once you get a job in the local council, you don't lose it, do you? You don't, you know, you don't suffer from the same sort of swinging cuts that come along and they go, sorry, we're going to have to lose this entire department.
No, and one of my theories about why I'm quite so obsessive about law and I like to do a lot of law and I, you know, pay a lot of attention and I work very, very hard.
This is why we want you here.
Well, that's very kind. But I, you know, I'm under a lot of pressure, Mike. I mean, I could get sued by my clients and lose my house.
Right.
So that makes me work at a certain level. You
know,
that level of direct accountability, direct fear, impacts how I behave.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas if you're another type of lawyer, you know, I won't necessarily name them, you're under very little risk.
Yes.
And so, and I'm not saying that that means they're all lazy, you know, let's try and avoid the hysteria we've had in the past. The point I'm just making is that I do think that impacts you.
Yeah.
Direct accountability,
sure.
Responsibility impact how you behave. That's human nature.
And I think everybody who's ever had to make a phone call to their local council will be very happy to tell you that it is not an easy thing to do. I had to have a conversation with my local council about a month or so ago because of some mistake they'd made with my council tax. Before I could find anybody, I'd spent 20 minutes on hold before somebody answered the phone and said, oh, we're very busy, can we call you back? And I went, when? And they went, tomorrow. And I said, when? Tomorrow, oh, between 8 and 5. I'm like, no, you can't call me back between. I work for a living. You know, you can't just call me whenever you want, you know.
Well, they're not incentivized to treat you as a customer.
No.
I mean, it's such a good point about taking risks, incentives. You know, if a council, for instance, decides to build, like Bournemouth Council did, this expensive new eco hub, they're not going to really bear the costs if that failed.
No.
I mean, a private enterprise would, but who will take the brunt of it? The taxpayer will. Then it's this very unhealthy dynamic that's opened up.
And I think the other thing as well is that we have lost, I think, from the time certainly when I was a young man, we've lost an awful lot of our own autonomy to these organisations. Yeah. You know, the local councils tell you where to put your rubbish. They fine you if you put it in the wrong bin. They fail to collect it most of the time anyway, you know, but they also tell you where you can drive, where you can park. You know, where a lot of small businesses have had to close their businesses down because of the extortionate rates that they're being made to pay.
Yes.
You know, I feel as though they've taken grip of the country.
Yeah.
Well, we are going to have to ask questions because I think for the first time ever, one of our political parties, their leader, is being advised by the second highest, formerly the second highest civil servant in the land. I mean, we used to keep them out of politics.
Yes.
And now they're running a political party.
Yes.
How did we get here?
Right. And I think it's the crowning, if you like, for me, of this sort of administrative class.
Yes.
We've created an administrative class. Keir Starmer actually personifies it because he's really not a politician. He's actually a jumped-up sort of, you know, council executive, not even a councillor. Because councillors can be a bit eccentric, they can be a bit weird. They're usually local. They usually have a kind of love for the community,
yeah.
Whether you like them or not. They might dress in sort of odd suits. But, you know, they're generally people that you can also elect and kick out. But these administrative class-type people have taken over everything. The civil service, they've taken over running, you know, the country. They run the local councils. They run everything.
Yes. Well, Rory Sutherland, the really interesting Spectator writer, has written so much on this about how you get a growth of a sort of bureaucratic class.
Yeah.
And they really strangle productivity. Mm. So they strangle productive members of society. It's why we have such a problem with building things.
If it moves, tax it, I think is their principle. Well, listen, great to see both of you. We'll have more to talk about coming up. Rachel says, my council is bankrupt. We have rats because the bins are emptied every 3 weeks. We have so much dog poo everywhere. The pavement is uneven. The bushes are overgrown to the point I hurt myself because of a bit of tree sticking out that I couldn't see. Yeah. That's, I think, a story of our times for this country. Yeah. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, the Rwanda disaster continues as homes earmarked for migrants are being sold to local buyers. Very dangerous there, isn't it? Do not go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Rishi's Rwanda scheme has faced yet another embarrassing setback after it's been discovered that 70% of the housing earmarked for migrants has now been sold off to local residents. Yep, that's right. The very property Suella Braverman touted as able to resettle thousands of people when touring them as Home Secretary have now been flogged. If my memory serves me correctly, Braverman called them beautiful. Well, it seems the resident of Kigali absolutely agreed with her. Joining me now is former UKIP leader, Mr. Henry Bolton. Henry, good to see you again.
Hi, Mike.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
Thank you.
I mean, just when you think somebody couldn't invent an even bigger twist to the tale, somebody keeps doing it. I don't know who's sitting behind the scenes in Downing Street going, yeah, this will be good. They haven't thought of this one. Never mind the fact that we haven't sent anybody to these places in Rwanda. Now we're going to sell off the places in Rwanda that they were going to be housed in. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, it is. I've got so many questions about this, but I can't give you real answers. But look, the first thing is, I mean, let's be fair to the Rwandans first. The Rwandan government has said no, it's not 70%; it's nearer 30%, and it may be that somehow the figures are reversed. But nonetheless, that's housing allocated to these people that we're intending to send that is being sold off to private owners,
right?
Who paid for those?
Right. That's a very good question.
Did we pay... Was part of the funding that the UK provided...
Yes.
Used to build these houses that have now been sold? If so, who is getting the money from that sale?
Right.
That's an important question.
Well, there are two things that I've been listening to and reading about today. One is that, you know, certainly if you go back to when Suella Braverman visited, you might remember she was sitting in this very nice little living room talking about how nice the furnishings were, talking sort of laughing about, oh, might get some home decorations done at home. there was no suggestion that these were going to be permanent housing for Rwandan refugees of any kind. Secondly, now, I've been hearing people reporting in from Africa saying, actually, quite a lot of people in Rwanda are not happy about the fact that the government is spending all this money creating housing for people from outside the country when there's quite a lot of people inside the country who don't have adequate housing.
Indeed, but my understanding was that we paid for a lot of that.
Yes, I'm sure that's true.
Was it this housing? The other thing is that again, being fair to the Rwandans, they have said, and I think this is wise, that they don't want to create enclaves of these whoever's sent.
Yeah.
So they want to mix them and integrate with them with the population, which superficially is a wise thing to do. Depends how you do it.
Yeah.
So I can see the logic there.
More but, like Britain in Rwanda, isn't it?
I'm not going to go there. But the other thing is, look, as you rightly pointed out, none of this was made clear to the British public.
Right.
None of this was described in the very thin plan that has been presented to our country. And I just wonder whether actually anybody in government has actually got their finger on this project.
Yeah.
Whether anybody... I mean, if it was a military operation, you'd have somebody who is leading that operation. Right. You'd have staff working that issue on top of it, the logistics, the operational, the assets that you need, or the whole nine yards.
Yeah, yeah.
There is nothing about any of this Rwanda story from start to finish that indicates to me that there is anything like that in Whitehall.
Right.
And if there is not, and I'm my belief going on what we see is that there is not, then we've got a very serious demand that we need to make of the Home Office and the government. Why the hell not?
Yes.
You're spending British taxpayers' money on this. You're making promises to the electorate on the basis of this. And you're diverting all the media onto this.
Right.
But you're not even planning it.
No.
Why not? Where are your planners? Who's in charge of this particular programme? We want to know.
And all we hear from Rishi Sunak, whenever he's interviewed, he was interviewed here just last week by Harry Cole from The Sun, is, you know, oh, yes, we will make sure that we get flights off to Rwanda.
That's all he wants.
Well, I wonder whether we want more than that, really.
Well we
because
do.
Because that's not enough, is it?
The British public want immigration reduced.
Yeah.
And they want to see that our borders are secure and that we're able to stop the small boats, or at least limit them down to a trickle.
Yeah.
And I think nobody expects them, you know, no boat to ever cross ever again.
No, I think people are reasonable about
that.
But let's face it, we haven't yet entered the very calming sort of waters of the summer months. And that could
lead to... And we're still way ahead of last year on the numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
We were told that the numbers last year were sort of because of the British government's efforts. Well, in that case, you know, those efforts have gone awry this year.
Yeah.
Of course, it wasn't down their efforts. It was down to the weather conditions and various other things.
Right.
And as I was saying last year, the numbers this year would go up because Italy was receiving half as many again as they had done in 2022.
Right.
And it takes time for that to feed through to the North French coast. But there is nothing about this supposed plan that's in there. It's a red herring. It's distracting everybody onto this. And yes, you're right. I think Rishi Sunak will declare a success when one flight takes off and lands in Rwanda, even if he's paid the £3,000 to each of the people on board, which is the plan, to get them to go quietly, if you like, not to appeal.
Right.
So that is not success in my mind.
Of course not.
That is not securing our borders. It shouldn't be success in the eyes of the British people either, because it is not securing our borders. It is simply a bit of window dressing, a sort of headline, media
moment.
It's
shifting the furniture around, isn't it?
It's not even shifting the furniture around, Mike. It's doing nothing on our borders.
No.
It's just, look, it's... I can't even call it window dressing.
No.
It will be, if he tries it, a pathetic, ridiculous, almost laughable attempt to bluff the British people that he's managed to deal with the problem.
Who I think are well past bluffing. I think
they are
well fed up with it. But
and
here's the other thing.
It's not so difficult to solve this problem.
Well, no, I know, but let me ask you this question, because my understanding is that in Europe now, many countries in Europe are doing a lot better in terms of deporting people that they want to deport.
They are. And that's because...
And how are they managing that, then?
Because they're putting the resources behind it. For example, Denmark.
Yeah.
They're putting the resources into their immigration staff.
Yeah.
They're putting state employees in there, if you like, civil servants, who they have control over the human resources management. They have control over their contracts. They have control over their training. They've got established training programs. Mm. We don't. Do you know, we still have no institutional border or training facility for border force.
Right.
OK, they're doing their training in meeting rooms and hotels.
But our civil servants are more and more woke with every passing week, more and more unlikely to support government policy on immigration. And in fact, plans are going to strike, I think, pretty soon.
Well, that's the other thing, of course. Have we got the government... Is the government of the machinery of government actually wanting to drive this?
Yeah.
If not, ministers are accountable to the British public.
Mm.
Ministers need to drive it. And if the head of the civil service is unable to drive the civil service forward in this way, the head of the civil service needs to go.
Yeah.
So do the senior management.
Yeah.
We've got to sort out our... the British public rightly hold politicians to account. Mm. And I think that the quality of our politicians is incredibly low at the moment, across the board, yeah, all parties.
I would say so.
But if they are accountable at the ballot, if they aren't able to deliver because the civil service is obstructing them, then we need to define that problem and deal with it. It's no good having a whole bunch of wet people in the cabinet unable to drive their own policy forward and drive the pledges that they've given to the British people.
No, I think that's absolutely right. Henry, thank you very much. Henry Bolton there. At the end of the day, I don't think they actually support their own policy. That's part of the problem. Yeah. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Still to come, Rayner on the run. Will the Labour deputy leader come out of hiding to answer questions over her alleged tax gains? Plus, will Labour actually explain what on earth they stand for? It's all to come. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Earlier today, Rachel Reeves announced Labour's revenue-raising plan after the government stole their non-dom policy. They will go even harder on tax dodgers, says the Shadow Chancellor. Yet, there's no mention of what they'll do with the alleged tax dodger at the heart of their own party. But you know the left, folks. One rule for us, another one for them. Rejoining me now in the studio, writer and broadcaster Candice Holdren and barrister and commentator Stephen Barrett. Thank you very much indeed for returning to us. This story is the story that just won't die. You know, it's just like one of those kind of Halloween horrors that keeps coming up out the grave just when you think it's safe to walk past the graveyard. Angela Rayner comes out and starts swearing at you, calling you Tory scum, even all the while making money from capital gains tax. Who would have thought that somebody in her position would think that making money from property was a good thing? I thought all property was theft.
Well, exactly. I mean, hasn't she even spoke about getting rid of the right to buy?
She has indeed. That's how this story started, because people said, look at the hypocrisy of this woman. She made a load of money from selling a house, and now she wants to do away with the right to buy a grant. And then they started looking into it, and they went, hang on a minute, she wasn't actually living there at the time.
Well, I think it's perfectly reasonable for people to be asking these questions. I mean, they've sort of battered it back, saying it's just a smear and I'm perfectly entitled to my own living arrangements. But most people would look at that and go, oh, that's slightly unusual.
Yes.
It doesn't quite make sense. And then, of course, you have neighbours who've said, well, I don't remember her living there.
Right.
And you've got the Mail Online, who's now done this big investigation into her social media posts, which overwhelmingly seems to suggest that she was living at one property. But, I mean, she's stonewalling.
Yeah.
Rachel Reeves is stonewalling.
Rachel Reeves basically said today, from what I can gather, that she hasn't evaded tax because she's my friend, which doesn't really stand up. I'm interested in your point of view on this, Stephen, because I think you tweeted about this before, because people are also saying Keir Starmer is claiming that he hasn't looked at the guidance that she got in order that he can avoid sort of having to say that he's got plausible deniability, effectively. Mm. You've got a sort of legal point that you can make about that, haven't you?
Yes. Well, I mean, the first one is to say that the consistent applications of rules to us all is the rule of law. Mm. And the rule of law is not a natural human state. It isn't just how we are by default. It takes an awful lot of work to maintain it.
Yeah.
The natural human default, because we're just a socialised ape. And the natural human default is...
Some are more socialised than others.
Well, that's very kind. But the natural state is ruled by violence, by strength, and that's how you get what you want. Mm. And we have an inverse version of that in this country, because nobody uses actual violence, but passive aggression, claiming to be victim, is used an awful lot in order to subvert the rule of law. Now, what Keir Starmer is doing would be rejected by a court, because he's almost trying to put himself into a situation of deliberate ignorance.
Mm. Mm.
You know, you cannot avoid knowing things. If you were perfectly, you know, you're the boss of the ship, and there's a report, and you're saying, oh, I'm not going to read the report. No, you can't do that. No,
you just can't. And surely at some point or other, and this is what always happens with these types of political stories, eventually, I mean, Alistair Campbell was the man who said, you know, if you're the story for 6 days, it's time to resign. I mean, this has been far longer than six days. I think she hasn't spoken publicly to the media for something like 11 or 12 days. Mm-hmm. And they keep pretending that it's all going to go away, and it keeps not going away.
Yeah, they're hoping it will go away. Mm. I mean, I bet they are so angry that this has come up.
Yeah.
Because they were just sort of hoping they could step back, not have to do much. The Conservatives were making so many unforced errors. But this is actually quite a serious thing, and it does get someone at the highest levels of the party on serious hypocrisy charges, not to mention other things which can only speculate.
Well, an awful lot of people who were put up by Labour this morning, apart from Rachel Reeves, to appear, I think there was a guy on Talk TV breakfast this morning, Peter Cardwell was talking to him, and he said, well, what about Angela Rayner? You know, since you're announcing this anti, you know, non-dom tax thing, what about your own tax dodger? And immediately they're on the back foot. So they, you know, you have to say if you're a team manager, you're kind of going, we're not getting the message out because of you, because of your problem.
Well, I mean, I don't... under the old system, I would never really talk about a political party because we used to have a law that they just governed themselves and they weren't subject to the courts and they, you know, we just put them over there away from law. And then that wall cracked during membership of the EU.
Yes.
Mm. And now we use the courts to interfere in political parties. So they're becoming much more
and
like...
And during the Brexit period law-like. As well.
Yeah, exactly. And I do this now for a living. I will sue the political parties for my clients because I now can in a way that previously I wasn't.
And is that a bad thing, you think, that's happened?
Well, it's a political position to say whether it's good or bad. So all I can ever do is highlight that our old system is... And it wasn't... I don't think it was consciously done. I'm not sure people understood. What they wanted was to have one system across Europe.
Yes.
And we just had a totally different system and sort of never said, oh, we're terribly sorry, but that doesn't actually work for us.
Right.
You know, because how Europe works. And it wasn't really done. And ever since then, nobody has sort of shored up that we could, if we wanted to, have that barrier up again, and take say that political parties are non-justiciable, and that would end a bit of my practice overnight. But you know, there we are. It doesn't matter. We don't govern for my benefit. But yeah, they're becoming law. So I will talk about the parties. And I will talk about constitutions. And I think there's a structural issue in the Labour Party constitution because she's directly elected, and so I don't think Starmer can sack her.
No. Right.
So I think, again, she just sat there going, well, I'm not resigning.
Right.
You can't sack me.
Yes.
And if that is the case, then you see that once you... All these people who believe in one single document constitution, well, let's use the political parties, because they've all got one single document constitution, to point out how badly that system works.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly
that's quite a...
Well, I mean, I think at one point there was a talk that he was trying to move her at the last reshuffle, wasn't there? And then there was a bit of a stramash behind the scenes.
Yes.
Suddenly she had another job and she still had the old job. You know, so she'd be made sort of, you know, deputy head of the party or something, in addition to being the deputy leader. But that's the other issue that people mistake, and I think David Lammy made a mistake on this, when he said the other day, oh, well, we should be held to a different standard because we're not in government. You know, sorry?
No.
Well, so how does that work?
Would he apply that to Conservatives?
Does that mean, you know, the further down the pecking order you are in Parliament, the more you can get away with?
That's
ridiculous.
I mean, that reasoning, it's just nuts. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you are the party in waiting, that you need lots of scrutiny.
Yeah.
We need to know what we're going to be getting or what we're going to
and
be
also,
voting
for. And
also,
as a party and as a party leader, you ought to want to be as clean as you can possibly be. You don't want to be going into a general election with some dodgy characters who might have got some stuff in the background that you don't want to publish.
It's true, but I think, you know, I think in some ways, though, this is Angela Rayner being hoisted by her own petard.
Yes.
Because, I mean, she's often led the charge against other politicians from the other side.
Right.
And, I mean, in a very inquisitorial way. And so, you know, it's sort of being turned back on her now. And we've entered this sort of... This type of politics now, where it's sort of, you know, my opponent isn't just different to me. My opponent is something morally repugnant.
Yes.
And I always have to hold them to account.
Right.
They're always disgraceful and corrupt.
Right.
And I think that she kind of does belong to that style of politics.
So. I think so. We'll probably explore this a bit more later, but just a quick mention of William Bragg, who's resigned this evening as a Tory MP. He's resigned the whip, apparently. As a senior Tory who's apparently said William Bragg has to sack himself because Rishi Sunak isn't strong enough to do it. There's a lot of sort of runes to be looked through here, isn't there? Can you sum it up for us, Stephen, in about 20 seconds?
Well, I mean, we are in a situation where an MP who was quite influential within the Conservative Party constitution, quite powerful on the 1922 committee, and we had a prime minister with a massive majority thrown out the window.
Yeah.
And this gentleman with his photograph is connected to this in some way. When I was a child, I think people would have just said this is a national security issue.
Right.
There would be sort of MI5.
Yeah, how can it not be?
I mean, I don't...
The police are now involved.
So, I mean, and I wouldn't want to comment on ongoing matters, but I can merely highlight that this is not unserious in any way.
No.
Yet very little action had been taken. And it's taken a very long time to get to the point of him removing the whip.
Yes.
I mean, that from himself.
Well, quite extraordinary, wasn't it, for Jeremy Hunt to call him brave for managing to cough up to having committed such a ridiculous and gross error, as you say, possibly damaging our national security. But we'll talk more about that coming up. Candice and Stephen, thank you very much indeed. You're watching the Independent Republican Mike Graham. Still to come, post office police inquiry gets serious with criminal proceedings at the bank with an unpronounceable name. Coming up after this. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republican Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now it's time for Taking the Mic. Now, there can be a few things more stupid than a bad corporate name change. I mean, whoever thought it would be a great idea to change the name of the post office and the Royal Mail to Consignia? But we all know the people running that business had other problems to deal with. Then there was Facebook and Twitter, both run by techie titans who decided a name change was what they required to further build their brands. Mark Zuckerberg changed Facebook to Meta, and Elon Musk rebranded Twitter to X. And after spending multi-millions of dollars, everyone still refers to them as Facebook and Twitter. Rebrands usually backfire. It didn't work for Gap. It didn't work for Leeds United or MasterCard when they changed their logos. And when Weight Watchers renamed themselves Wellness and Wellbeing, everyone just fell about laughing. This week, we can welcome another corporate titan into the land of ludicrous revamps. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you Aberdeen. But not really Aberdeen, because it's now spelt... That's right. Aberdeen, without the vowels, or something unpronounceable like... Believe it or not, this idea was hatched by grown-up people who have paid a lot of money to come up with new ideas for marketing companies. Some supposedly very clever people at media agency Wolf Olin sat around in think pods and shared spaces for months before they landed on this one. But I'm afraid it's more like something from the thick of it than a sensible renaming of a big corporation. Where do they find these people? Predictably, the name change has created howls of laughter and hilarity in the rest of the sensible world. Wolf Olin's, who were one of the key agencies behind the marketing at the 2012 Olympics, are keeping shtum. But the mockery of the name has really upset Peter Branner, the chief investment officer of Aberdeen. Or should we call him... he has accused the media of corporate bullying. Several headlines in newspapers just missed out vowels, as you would, to poke fun at the financial behemoth, which currently has £495 billion worth of assets under management. Some commentators also accused the company of dropping E's and suffering from irritable vowel syndrome. Get it? Our whined, I understand that corporate bullying, to some extent, is part of the game with the press, even though it's a little childish to keep hammering the missing vowels in our name. Would you do that with an individual? How would you look at a person who makes fun of your name day in, day out? It's probably not ethical to do it. But apparently, with companies, it's different. Poor Parker won't get any sympathy here, though. The company decided to rebrand five different names under this particularly stupid umbrella. It was meant to end confusion, but all it's done is to give everyone a good laugh. Except for the shareholders, of course, who watched the share price drop last month when 2023's annual results were published. All in all, guys, it's a bit of a It's quite hard, actually, isn't it, to get away from all of that. But now, Alan Bates, the man who has inspired the ITV post office drama, has given evidence at the inquiry into the scandal today. Hundreds of sub-postmasters were prosecuted due to the faulty Horizon IT software. In his evidence, Mr. Bates claimed the organisation was run by thugs in suits and was willing to do anything and everything to hide the failures. He also told the inquiry he first warned the post office of issues with the computer software back in 2000. Saying they spent 23 years trying to silence him.
We're going to make a lesson of my case because a number of other people knew what was going on at that time. And I think it was something the post office liked to try and give lessons of how they were in charge.
Joining me now is Paul Scully, Conservative MP and former Post Office Minister. Paul, very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic.
Good evening to see you. Hi, Mike.
It's good to see Mr. Bates finally getting his day in court, as it were, finally able to say the things that they've been trying to stop him from saying for a very long time. He's actually calling now for a criminal investigation into some of these people. And I think many people in this country would agree with him that that's what is now required, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that may well be the case. What I want to see is that all the questioning is done in the inquiry that needs to be done, because you've got Alan that's spoken today, you've got Lord Arbuthnot, who's been an amazing champion for the Postmasters tomorrow, and then you're going to have a number of the chief execs and chairman and PR people from the post office, as well as Fujitsu and other people over the next few weeks. And that will really give us an idea about who knew what when. And if we need to then do the investigation, just what we will, in terms of whether there needs to be prosecutions and indeed convictions, then that's the time to do it.
Yeah. I mean, to call people thugs in suits, I mean, he's not messing around. He's not mincing his words. And I think he probably knows better than everyone how this all went wrong and how long they kept it quiet. Because I don't think there's any doubt now that there was plenty of opportunities to raise this problem before it was raised. And as we know well, Paul, you and I have spoken about this many times, were it not for that ITV drama, we wouldn't even be here.
Well, look, two things. I think I was slightly disagree with you in terms of were it not for the ITV drama. I think what that's helped us do is speed things up. But I think we were already doing a lot of work. I set up the statutory inquiry, albeit a few years ago. I started the compensation scheme going way too slowly, but we're trying to do what we can. But you know what? You're absolutely right that we should be in pole position to figure out what we need to now do about holding some of these people properly to account. Because Alan and other people have had the most awful experience. This is the biggest miscarriage of justice in British court history. People have had their lives destroyed based on a state-owned institution.
Yes. And I know, Paul, that you've done your part and you've always been very much out there supporting the people who were the victims in this particular ghastly miscarriage of justice. However, you know, there are lots of people who have been deliberately trying to stall things, who have been deliberately trying to mislead people. Fujitsu, as we know, is still embedded pretty well into the government with all sorts of contracts that they're still getting paid very, very well for. Thank you very much indeed. You know, it took a sort of campaign by newspapers and others to get Paula Wendels to actually give up her honour and all of that. And I know that that's all sort of window dressing in a way, but I was hearing a story just the other day that one of the victims who committed suicide many years ago has got a wife who still hasn't received any compensation and is now being told that she probably won't get any anyway, since he was actually the sub-postmaster.
Well, actually, I'm not sure I know about that story. If they get in touch with me, I'd honestly follow that up.
Okay.
Because what these people need, and I've said this right from the beginning, whether it's the victims or the victims' families or whatever, they need life-changing money.
Yeah.
It was a state-owned institution that wrecked these people's lives. And so we need to make sure there is nothing more we can do than just act. We can't talk, we need to act.
Yes, exactly right. Because there does come a point in these kinds of stories as well, Paul, where, yes, life-changing money will make a difference, and we're talking, in some cases, I think, 700, 750,000, maybe more. But equally, there's an awful lot that these people suffered that can never really be recovered. You know, you can't recover the life of somebody who's dead. You can't recover, you know, dozens and dozens of situations where people lost their credit rating, lost their houses, lost their families, were ridiculed. I mean, and I'm not blaming you for this. I'm just saying, you know, there's no way really to recompense people for that.
You're so right. Look, and I mean, when I talk about life-changing money, it literally is trying to restore people's lives. But you're so, so right. If these people have had their lives destroyed. Mm. You can't talk about this. You can't give them warm words. They don't care about that. These are people that, whether they're government ministers, whether they're post office executives, whether they're other officials or whatever, everybody that's spoken to them, even legal professionals, that everyone that's spoken to them has let them down. Mm. It's about action. It's about the life-changing money that can help. It won't bring their life back to where it was, but it will help.
And as far as you understand it at the moment, Paul, where is that kind of situation as far as how soon can people expect the money? Because I know there are still several different schemes going. Some people have had money. Some of that was taken by lawyers. There's new schemes being opened up all the time. Some people are still fighting. I mean, can we realistically say that we're making progress at this point?
Yeah, we can. And what I've said when I've been asked, I would if I had my time again, I would have just brought it all in house. What I'm really pleased now that Kevin Hollenrake, the current Postal Affairs Minister, has brought it in house and he's effectively, you know, dealing with it within it as a sort of really empathetic minister. Mm. And he wants to get as much done by August as we can with the people that have had their had a conviction that needs quashing. That will take a little bit longer because of the legislation that we need to get through. But what you're seeing now with the statute inquiry is that we also need to get the answers that we can then make sure that we don't just talk about the fact that this can't happen again. We make sure it can't happen again. And that will happen by the end of the year. So Wynn Williams, the judge, the retired judge that's leading this, will find out everything he needs to know. He will then be able to write up his report beginning of next year. And we will then be able to start. If we need prosecutions and what have you, that can then start. But we've got to make it stick so that it really can't happen again. Right.
And your personal involvement has been quite quite deep into this story, but you're, I think, standing down, aren't you, at the next election? We don't know when that is.
Yeah, I am.
Will that affect anything? Now, what I'm saying is the fact that if the government does change, does that change the report when it gets published, anything like that?
No, I don't think it will. You've got people like Kevin Jones, you've got other people in the Labour Party that have been really at the heart of campaigning longer than I am. I have been. But it's just, for me, it's personal because I was the Postal Affairs Minister that was able to have the judgment from Lord Justice Fraser, the GLO, the court case that happened when Alan Bates was leading that at the end of the drama that lots of people have seen. I was able to take that and grab that.
Yeah.
And so I was able to humanise, I suppose, this. But people like Kevin Jones and people in the Labour Party have been able to do this. So I think we all know now what the scale of this is. We all know we need to sort it out. So I don't think a change of government will matter in there. This is just a government rather than a political government's point of view that we just need to get this done and recompense people as best we can.
No, sure. Before I let you go, let me just ask you about William Bragg. He's resigned the party whip tonight over the Westminster honey trap story. He'd already resigned from being deputy chair, I think, of the 1922 committee. But we're hearing that some senior Tories are saying he had to fire himself because Rishi Sunak didn't have the balls to do it. What do you make of that?
I must admit, look, it's good that he resigned the committees that he was on. I think the only person that can sack you as an MP should be your lecturer. So I'm glad he's taken the wherewithal to do the stuff on about resigning the whip. I hadn't heard that until now. But he's been stupid. He's been so inappropriate. He's had a lot of emotional issues, and I differentiate that with mental health issues because we have emotional well-being and mental health are two separate, very separate things. Yeah. But look, you know, the guy has been suffering. He's going and at the next election anyway. And I think we'll, over the next few months, you know, Hazel Grove will get a different MP. And that's understandable.
All right. Paul Scully, thank you very much indeed. Good to see you, Paul. Thanks a lot. You're watching the Independent Republican Mike Graham. From the fire in your house to the car you drive, we ask why Scotland has got itself into a frenzy with banning almost anything that brings joy. All that's coming up and more after the break.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and we're on your smart speaker. Coming up in the second hour of the show, policing the impossible. The Scottish police are in despair as they attempt to keep up with hate crime complaints. And celebrity support. Singer Fergal Sharkey joins campaigners in calling for a clean-up of England's largest lake. That's Windermere. Plus, Scrabble's going to change for the first time in its 75-year history as part of a new inclusive drive to deter people who find words intimidating. Unbelievable. For those of you who are veterans of the Independent Republic, you will know by now that much of my daily ire is reserved for those in the public sector who waste so much of our money. Whether it is the BBC, the many bloated local councils across the land, or the devolved parliaments in this country, my crusade against waste and tomfoolery is largely aimed at those who spend other people's money with impunity. Today is no different, for I've discovered yet another absolute nonsense of an idea which will inevitably cost taxpayers an arm and a leg. And that's on top of all the limbs we have already provided these gargantuan financial black holes. This time, it comes from the four-day week brigade. You know the ones. The people who have spent the last few years telling us how much more efficient people are working 4 days a week instead of five. It should be noted that these are the same idiots who reckon those who work from home are more efficient than those who actually bother to come to work. I don't believe either argument because they simply don't stack up. But wait, the flexible working fundamentalists have got a problem because someone has worked out that the four-day week is actually racist because it discriminates against the very people it is meant to help. And they are largely from the ethnic minority workforce. Well, I never. It turns out some office workers can do a four-day week easier than others. Some are more manual. They are labourers, even in the public sector. Well, I could have told them that. In fact, I have been telling them that for years. Rather like I told the work-from-home zealots that they might love sitting in their gardens tapping away on a laptop, but the Amazon drivers and supermarket workers would have to go to work just the same, no matter what. You can't operate a forklift from home, either. It will come as no surprise to you that this latest report in the form of a stream of consciousness is emanating from the Welsh Government, who say that a trial scheme for public sector workers should see their hours slashed by 20% with no loss of pay. It's clearly ridiculous. And now, apparently racist against frontline workers. Why? Because although AI could improve efficiency, the four-day week would widen inequalities that already exist, especially where workers are on shift patterns 24/7 and not working from an office or a home. The Welsh say they are following on from a trial in Scotland brought in by Humza Useless. That's going so well that many Scots are begging Useless to go on a zero-hours contract and just not turn up for work at all. The bottom line for the four-day week is that Wales would need to hire 179 extra staff on full-time contracts in order to supply the same services if they gave everyone an extra day off. These people are running the country. Is it any wonder we are deep in the doo-doo? Now, later on in the show, we'll be bringing you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at the Metro newspaper. And you're not going to believe this. It's all about rats. Rats infesting NHS wards. Rats infesting hospitals. Rats infesting mortuaries. Rats infesting the entire medical network in this country. Well, you know, there are insects biting legs of staff. There are cockroaches. There are flies. There are maggots. But the worst thing of all is if you're working in a safe environment, which is supposed to be medically, clinically sealed. What are you supposed to do when you walk into a room to get some bandages and you get greeted by a giant rat? I mean, you're going to be scared out of your wits, aren't you? There's a giant rat in the room. I can't put my hand down there. That's unbelievable. We'll be talking more about that, of course, coming up a little bit later on when everybody comes back in for the panel discussion. But let's go north of the border for a little bit of bagpipery, because embarrassed is a word that keeps coming up after a turbulent inaugural week for Scotland's hate crime legislation. There are certainly louder, more emotional adjectives flying around, but in the messages that pass between serving and former police officers across Scotland, the common theme is one of just that simple embarrassment. After a deluge of complaints, some fear the clumsily written new hate crime legislation is seriously going to harm the police force's credibility. Let's talk now to nightclub owner and columnist, Mr. Donald McLeod of the Clan McLeod. Donald, very good evening to you, sir.
Hello, mate. Good evening and welcome to the People's Republic of Independent Scotland, totalitarian Scotland.
Oh, my God. I mean, I've been looking at some of the statistics, Donald. Now, we've got plenty to talk about tonight. You're going to banning, you know, smoke-filled rooms. You can't have, you know, wood-burning stove. You can't park anywhere. You can't go out at night without paying an ULEZ charge. Unbelievable. But let's start with the hate crime. 8,000 in the first week reported. Hums are useless, the main beneficiary of most of those reports. An old firm game where there were more people complaining about hearing chants in their living rooms from the Rangers fans at Ibrox. I mean, what's going on?
Oh, it's mental up here. It's absolutely cracker. Then I don't know where to begin. You know, there's just been so much nonsense going on. You know, as you said, there was 8,000 complaints in the first week. Yeah. There's been, that equates to what I think it was the Telegraph that put this out, 416,000 in a year, which means there's only 58,000 assaults in Scotland reported in a year. But this is in the back of police numbers being at the lowest levels for 15 years.
Right.
And you know, 29 police stations getting shut. I mean, the words cluster and something else comes to mind. It really is a diabolical piece of legislation, which every, you know, I don't know anybody that supports it. I've not heard anybody say, oh, this is a great idea, except, you know, the SNP Green administration, you know, the gift that keeps on giving, or sorry, the gift that keeps taking away, taking away our freedoms.
Didn't Anna Sawa back it as well for Labour, though?
Well, I've talked to Anas about this, you know, and he said, well, you know, this was, you know, 3 years ago that they agreed on this and they wanted to put in an amendment to the bill, which was thrown out. But, you know, there's many, many politicians are totally against this, but I can see that, it's just a mess. But a lot of them are just sitting back and watching the lumps of wood and the SNP Greens making the mistakes and so that they can dive in. But, you know, to us, we're just sick of it. We're just sick of one piece of nonsense after another. You know, you've got the hate crime bill. Now, today, this has been the mental communication about the banning of wood fire stoves and heaters. And, you know, it's just full of hot air. You know, are we going to get smoke police now out in into the Highlands checking and see if you've got a burner on or not? But the messaging has been wrong because of that it's new build houses. But still, that's no small comfort, you know, for those that live out in the rural areas who can't, you know, access heating like they're not, you know, like we can, like electricity. They've got to use petroleum gas at times. And then they're hit with storms after storms after storms. So now the Scottish government said, well, you're allowed a wood burner, but only, you know, only as an emergency.
Right. All of this, Donald, is all being driven, isn't it, by these clean air fanatics. They're the same people who are driving, you know, the ULEZ zone in Glasgow, all of the, the dislocation of the car business where they're trying to dissuade you from going in a car because they want to have clean air. But, you know, as you know better than me, there's a motorway going through the middle of Glasgow. The clean air zone now, by the way, I noticed this when I went out to Heathrow the other week to go to America. The clean air zone has been expanded by the mayor of London to Heathrow Airport. So you've now got planes taking off. You've got planes taking off about every sort of 25 seconds, and it's supposed to be a clean air zone for cars.
Well, mate, you know that I've been banging on about this for ages. We actually went to court against LEZ in Glasgow. Yeah. You know, here's a stat that I put in my column in the Herald this week. You know, a 200,000 drop-off in footfall in the same period, January, February 2023 to today. 200,000 people, less people coming into the city. 35,000 people hit with fines. You know, there is no wonder that people are deserting the city when you've got these punitive punishments, you know, hitting poor working class people. Right. You know, Glasgow has become, you know, as I said, it's a depressing fall from grace for this dear green place, you know, which could be a euphemism because it really is a dear. And it's the green zealots that are driving through these crazy policies. Right. I mean, and they're costing people jobs. There was another thing out today. 29,000 retail jobs have been lost in Scotland in the past year. Mm. Now, that's retail. God, what is hospitality? Yeah. It must be, I would reckon, six figures. Mm. And so this administration, they're damaging, they're economic vandals, and they're letting the Scottish people down. Far from sticking up for them, they're leaving them by the wayside. And really, we cannot, a day can't come soon enough in which they're out of power. But sadly, up here, it's going to be another 2 years after the general election before we get that chance. So it doesn't matter what happens in the general election. We are stuck with it, and it's just getting worse. I don't see any plans. I don't see them coming. It's just them coming back from any of the LEZ or the high parking charges that's also destroying Glasgow, scaring people away. I don't see any. You know, I'm not hearing anything. They should be cancelling or suspending LEZ. They should be reducing parking fees, not increasing them. They should be encouraging people back to work. You know, given that Glasgow is full of public service workers, they should be office workers, they should certainly be pulling them back in. But no, I think, you know, they're going to give them another day off, I think. Right. You know, and, you know, ultimately they should be stopping ripping up these roads to replace them with empty bus lanes and empty cycle lanes, Deliveroo expressways I call them, because that's only bites you see in them. So it is, as I say, economic vandalism, and it's costing a lot of people their business.
Saw a picture, I'm not sure if it was accompanying your excellent column in the Herald this week, but there was a picture of what was reported to be Sucky Hall Street, which looked as if there was fences going down either side of the road. There was a chair stuck in the middle, which was like just an ordinary office chair. There was rubbish in there. There were presumably rats running wild. Is there literally no road now that you can drive down in Sucky Hall Street?
Well, that was a pedestrian precinct. That was a tree-lined boulevard.
Right.
And they decided to rip it up to replace it with another tree-lined boulevard. But fell out with the contractors and have left this massive Harris fence, letter-strewn Harris fence, you know, right, the whole strip of the pedestrian precinct. So people come out of the train, says, walk up, you know, Buchanan Street, and that's what greets them. This, you know, massive, muddy, letter-strewn trench. It's a disgrace. And apparently, it's okay. It's just a transitional period, we're told. It will be fixed in November, you know.
Amazing.
You know, it's like the joke I said last week. You know, my wife said to me, I make love like a painter. I said, what, like Da Vinci, smooth strokes, attention to detail, the result of a masterpiece? She says, nah, like the council, rush the job, leave a mess, and I have to finish it myself. You know,
exactly right.
That's where we are.
But I mean, Scotland used to be a fun country. I lived there for many years. You know, my parents come from there.
We're not going to be beaten.
Well, you've got to have that attitude now, haven't you? It's a bit like down here. You know, the world's gone mad down here. You know, nobody knows what's going on. You know, the government don't appear to have any control over anything that's happening. But, you know, Humza Yousaf has come out tonight, just before you came on, actually, his message to Scotland, saying that it's a wonderful place. He wants to wish Eid Mubarak to Muslims around the world, celebrating Eid at the end of Ramadan. It's a time to be grateful for the blessings in all our lives and to reflect on how we can spread kindness and compassion to those less fortunate. I want to wish all Muslims a happy and blessed Eid. Well, that's all very well, and there's nothing wrong with it, but how about the rest of Scotland? You know, is he wishing them some kind of a happy weekend?
Well, you know, I don't think he's a bad guy. I just don't think he's capable of running a country. I think he's miles away from that. I don't think he could run a shop. I don't think he could get my paper. I don't think he could do anything. But the point is, I don't think he's bad. But spreading kindness and wishing that in Scotland, yes, we all want that. But a hate crime law doesn't do that. It divides, it polarises, it separates, it encourages people to go snitch on neighbours and pick up the phone and, you know, try and get them, the police involved in chat. And, you know, it's nonsense. It's just nonsense. And, you know, we have to put the brakes on it all. We have to put the brakes on the LEZ, all this traffic madness, all this road chaos. We have to put the brakes on this hate crime bill because it's clearly not fit for purpose.
Yeah.
And we've got to put our brakes on the Greens because the Greens are actually, as I said, economic vandals. They do not care. I don't think they can even agree a policy amongst themselves, except what, you know, they just want to destroy the country, as far as I'm concerned. And we have to have a clear out of politics up here, and politicians up here, because the ones that are serving us are not, as I say, not fit for purpose and not doing a good job.
And if you wanted to look at a bit of old-fashioned crime, of course, you could look no further than Dundee, where Humza Yousaf's brother-in-law today was arrested and charged with abduction and extortion over the death of somebody who fell from a flat in Dundee. Now, we can't go into the case, obviously, but, you know, it's not great timing for old Humza, is it? Hate crime over here, 8,000, you know.
It's not a great look, mate, you know, and, you know, you can't blame Humza for his brother-in-law, you know. I know a lot of people would like to, but you can't really go there, but it's just not a good look. And, you know, it's like all these other things that I've just mentioned and more, it's just not been a good look. It doesn't make Scotland look great. It doesn't sell the nation. It doesn't encourage investment in. It actually makes us look small-minded, you know, like small-minded criminals that can just get away with murder. Hopefully that's not the case, but, you know what I'm saying? It's just we're not projecting the great Scottish spirit, the one of, you know, welcoming, one of banter, the one of joy. And, you know, we're a very hardy nation, as you know, and we can give and take, but we're now separating people. It really is divisive what's happening up here. And you know what gets me? Some of the Uber Nats out there, you know, the Tartan Taliban, they just don't want to hear what we're saying. Mm. You know,
yeah, because they don't want any criticism, do they?
They don't want it. You can shove it in front of them. You can feed it down their throat. You can give it to them intravenously, but they don't want to know. Well, in Dundee, they might be doing that.
Right. Well, that's another story. But here, one final question for you. If me and Kevin O'Sullivan come up to the garage to do a Thought Police show, what are the chances of us ending up in Berlini?
Very good. Very good. You know, I'll make sure of that. You know, I know a few people there. They would look after you well, mate.
Yeah.
One's called Big Bubba.
But this is the thing.
Kevin, I mean, can go first.
But it's true. I mean, comedians, you know, people are going to be worried about going up there and getting done over and not getting out alive.
I'm worried now. I may be getting reported now for just saying that. You
certainly
know.
Hope so. Yeah, absolutely right. Well, I can tell you, look forward to it too. Well, listen, keep the faith and keep the good fight going because we need you very much at this time. It's a difficult time. Donald Cameron MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, MBE, of course, as well. Coming up, former Undertones singer Feargal Sharkey has lent his voice to the campaign to save Windermere, joining their strike against sewage earlier today. I'm joined now by the founder of the Save Windermere campaign. We've spoken before about this, Matt Staniak. Matt, welcome back to the Independent Republican, Mike Graham. Good to see old Feargal. He was here not that long ago. And then I ran into him the very next day at the England Ireland rugby match at Twickenham. So he's a busy boy, but he found time to come up to Windermere. Tell us what he was saying and what he was doing.
Yeah, it was fantastic to have him. You know, like you know, he's a phenomenal voice in this topic of the sewage scandal that's rocking our nation. And just to have him there was once again, you know, re-emphasising one of our long-standing points that Windermere is this nation's greatest natural asset and it needs to be protected. So just to have him there and to bring all his knowledge, all his charisma to the topic of conversation was really exciting to have him.
Yeah. And what was the event today as such? Because you and I spoke a few weeks back about the trouble with, you know, the water in general in this country and the fact that rivers are still polluted more than they should be, and Windermere in particular, because it's a body of water, you know, doesn't have the ability to lose anything horrible that goes into it. You know, what's changed since then, if anything?
Nothing's changed since we last spoke. We actually had the new storm spilling data that was released just a couple of weeks ago now. So last year alone, United Utilities discharged over 8,787 hours of untreated sewage in the Windermere catchment, all of which has then flown into Lake Windermere itself. It takes the total since 2020 to over 27,700 hours of untreated sewage that has found its way into the lake. What we saw with Fergal the other day was that he was joining our weekly strike against sewage. So United Utilities opened up an information centre in the heart of Windermere itself. So once a week between 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the morning on a Monday, we sit outside for an hour to protest the fact that they are dumping sewage into the lake. You know, right. They can put up as much information as they want. They can say what they like, but that's the truth of the matter. They are dumping sewage into Windermere. And as a result of it, our lake is suffering whilst their dividends continue to increase.
Yeah, I mean, I was staggered last week when I came in back from holiday to do Plank of the Week, and we put Thames Water in there because of the Oxford-Cambridge boat race, where an awful lot of the Oxford rowers complained about being ill. They'd suffered from all sorts of horrible stomach bugs because of the water that they were training in for the race in the River Thames, and the levels of E. coli sort of higher than ever. And all Thames Water said was, well, of course, what we're doing now is we're informing you when the pollution gets so bad that you probably shouldn't go in the water. So we've upped our kind of abilities to tell you where the pollution is, as if that's some kind of, make do and mend. You know, it's not. They have to stop polluting, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just shows, you know, the feeling from the water industry that it's their right to dump sewage and, you know, we just have to deal with it. And what Fergal's phenomenal at is raising that point that we don't have to put up with this anymore. Right. You know, since it's been 50 years since privatisation, the water companies have extracted all the money that was necessary to improve this system. And, you know, we've got to start asking the question as to where's the money gone, because it's not been put into a service that is being provided for the people of this nation. And for somewhere like Windermere, you know, like I said earlier, it's the country's greatest natural asset, and it's being exploited for profit and for greed.
Right.
And, you know, as a result of that, Windermere goes green every year. And like you're saying about things like E. coli and other nasties that come from sewage directly, the sewage in Windermere is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, contributor to phosphorus in the lake, which is then fueling the blue-green algal blooms in Windermere. Right. Those blooms are potentially toxic to you. You know, blue-green algae has been known to kill people before, kill dogs. Mm. And, you know, we are seeing the destruction of Lake Windermere.
And I'm not often one to sort of seek solace in the law, because it's not always the answer. But is there anything sort of legally that you could do? Is there anything you've thought about legally that you could do and junk the water companies or somehow force them to at least adhere to the basic rules they're supposed to adhere to?
Yeah, I think what you're touching on there is a really interesting point of, well, where is the regulator in all of this? Because the regulator has a duty to be watchdogs for the environment and to ensure that the water companies are complying with the law. Lo and behold, they're not. One of the key examples of legislation that we have is the fact that we are only supposed to see storm spilling in exceptional circumstances, which is, you know, defined as such a rare and freak occurrence that not one person could possibly predict it to happen. Whilst the agency in the Windermere catchment is permitting storm spilling to occur in 0.25 millimetres of rainfall. So a quarter of a millimetre of rain is allowed to fall in the Lake District before United Utilities has got the go-ahead from the Environment Agency to start dumping sewage into the rivers and into Lake Windermere. Yeah. You know, it's such a huge problem that people need to realise is that the regulation has totally and utterly failed.
Yeah.
They're not fit for purpose. They're not doing their job. And as a result of it, the water companies see this massive loophole and they are exploiting it. And as a result of it, we suffer.
Mm. It is absolutely shocking. What's your next move? What have you got planned? I mean, you're going to keep these strikes up, obviously, but what else can we expect from you?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, our next strike, which comes on Sunday, it's going to come on Monday, but we're going to start it on Sunday because it marks the 24th week since we've been striking outside of United Utilities Information Centre. So to mark that and to celebrate, we're going to strike from 10 a.m. on the Sunday to 10 a.m. on the Monday. So we're going to do 24 hours straight outside of United Utilities Information Centre. We've got a few things that we'll do in that period of time, but we're also being joined by Steve Coogan. He's going to come down and lend his voice to the strikes and to raise that awareness and profile. So that's coming this week. And then in terms of what's coming in the future, it's definitely worth people signing up to the campaign, keeping an eye on what's coming, because there's some really exciting stuff on its way.
Okay. Matt, good to see you again. Thanks very much indeed. Keep up the good work. We'll see what we can do. Matt there talking to us about the terrible state of Lake Windermere and the campaign, now joined by Fergal Sharkey, of how to stop these water companies, who seem to have no clue as to whether or not they should be doing something more, because they ought to surely be doing more to stop this ridiculous and horrible, quite frankly, sewage infestation of all of our waterways. And as I say, the water companies seem to think it's an improvement in their service if they actually tell you when the sewage has entered the water, when the rivers are not safe to swim in, when the sea is being polluted, when it rains, when they're pumping stuff into a lake where the water has nowhere else to go. As long as they tell you that it's horrible, that's fine. Well, it isn't fine, is it? Clearly. They need to get their act together. As he says, the regulator needs to get their act together as well, because nobody is holding the water companies responsible. And they're making millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds at our expense while making a complete and utter dog's dinner of our environment. Absolutely shocking. Absolutely shocking. Matt Staniak there talking to us from Windermere. A good guy. I think one of the guys that's worth supporting. You're watching the Independent Republican Mike Graham. Up next, all the mania from today's news with my panel, including German zombies at the Euros and giant mutant rats. All that and more. Stay right there. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republican Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Let's bring in my panel. They're all here. Journalist Emma Wolfe, barrister and writer Stephen Barrett returns, and journalist Eve Toffic. Well, very warm welcome to all of you, the two of you who haven't been here before. But listen, we've been talking about loads of stuff which we'll get into, but we've got to kick off, I think, tonight with something rather odd, which I spotted in the Times this morning. And it's a guy in America who apparently went out on a date with somebody. She decided, because I'm not at all familiar with the way of these things, but she decided to give him a bad review, effectively, on some kind of social media app, which then went viral. And lots of other women who apparently knew this guy as well agreed that he was a bad date. He's now suing them all. Sounds like a bit of a weird stalker-type guy, right? He's now suing them all, including serving them with court papers personally and filming himself doing it. I mean, what's this all about? Is this the modern way of dating?
Well, we do live in a very, very odd climate.
We do.
But where people can review each other after a bad day,
right,
or a good day. But this man sounds like he sounds absolutely toxic.
Mm.
And the fact that he's now serving them court papers.
Yes.
For basically saying he's a wrong and he's dodgy,
right,
stay,
right,
away. They're,
yes,
just warning other women.
Yeah.
I mean, why shouldn't they express their views about their date?
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, I'm very well out of all of this because I don't think I'd want to be either reviewing people or being reviewed. But this guy's effectively reviewed himself and proved himself to be a complete and utter idiot, hasn't he?
Well, so in this field of law, they have a concept called the Streisand effect.
Yes.
Which is where by the act of suing somebody for defamation, you make yourself look even worse than the original criticism.
Right.
And I think...
Is that what he's suing them for?
This must be the Streisand effect at work, because he will make himself, although it's his personal political opinion, he will make himself look worse by the dint of doing this. I do wonder how much of this is based because the American legal system is still so bad at damages. I mean,
yeah,
even when I was a child, we had the, yeah, ridiculous McDonald's hot coffee case.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but what happens is we stopped this 100 years ago, but they still let juries assess,
yeah,
damages. And juries are not, they're emotional creatures.
Right.
And if you get, you know, somebody like me who who uses arts, actually, that I don't use in court, but, you know, emotional, manipulative arts, you can get them really sympathetic to your plaintiff. And then you get ridiculous numbers come out, whereas in this jurisdiction...
Yeah, people getting hundreds of millions of dollars, right?
And it's absurd. In this jurisdiction, we stop that very simply by just having judges that if I started off on one, you know, imagine the poor babies, right. The judge would just go, shut up, Mr. Barrett, can you stop that?
What's your point?
You know, and we...
But, I mean, is this guy... I don't know even how much you know about the story. Is he seeking damages, this guy? Does he want to be given damages? Or does he want his reputation, you know, wiped clean?
I think in the process of seeking damages, he wants to keep his reputation. I think that ship has sailed.
I think so.
And something about these groups, you know, like the TripAdvisor for dating, I think it's quite a good idea. It's a bit soulless, but to be honest, dating nowadays is soulless.
It sounds awful.
I think it's good. You can filter out the weirdos, the losers.
Yeah, but what if there's some crazy woman who decides that she wants to just ruin somebody's reputation and say,
that's the other side.
This is what this guy does, and I suppose you have to wait and see what everybody else says.
There was a more serious instance of this, which I read a few weeks ago.
Yes, I know what you're going to say. This is a Times piece, yeah. Really interesting.
It was really interesting. Yeah. It was a woman who started writing about this man that she dated, and he, I think, had got her pregnant.
Yeah.
He had stayed with her. He had taken hundreds of thousands of pounds in money.
And he disappeared, didn't he, in the
And he disappeared.
Right.
But it then turned out that he'd done it to many, many other women.
Yes.
And so this guy is actually quite dangerous.
Right.
But it turned out in the end that he didn't even have a place to live.
Right.
He was literally living with all of these women, impregnating them all. It was really appalling.
And using all the same excuses as to why he couldn't
Same story
be with them.
Each time.
It's amazing how many duplicitous people there are out there, though, isn't it? I mean, I'm quite staggered by these kinds of stories.
I mean, have you watched Cheaters, the American show, where they catch people cheating? It makes me feel
but
like everybody's
But people have always cheated.
It.
I mean, it just seems that this is a bit more malevolent somehow. I mean, you know, people have always been unfaithful. People have always had affairs. But it seems to have taken on a more kind of, I don't know...
Something about preying
darker,
on quite vulnerable
sort of
women.
And maybe the whole social media thing is making it easier.
Well, you know my theory, Mike. If we're not actively fighting a vice, it'll be getting worse.
Right.
Has anybody been talking about honesty and duty and integrity? Have we actually been trying to promote those in the past? Or have we been promoting self-indulgence, self-fulfillment, you know, getting what you want all of the time? Because, it's become uncool to have sort of what I would think of as noble or chivalric values.
Right.
And that's really old-fashioned.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, actually, those are core components of humans behaving well.
Right.
And actually, one of the core components of humans behaving badly is humans getting everything that they want. They tend to get... Humans get worse.
I mean, people call it simping when a man really is attentive and nice to their partner.
Right.
I mean,
like
I'd rather have a simp than an abusive arsehole,
well,
to be quite
true.
Honest.
I think... I mean, hopefully there's something in between. I mean, you would like to think. But, I mean, that brings us, I guess, onto our political discussion earlier about Willie Ragg, because, you know, people who now appear to be in politics don't seem to have any standards of their own. They don't seem to think that they've ever done anything wrong, even going to Angela Rayner and all of that. It's all about what can you get away with. You know, it's not about sort of holding your hands up and going, I made a mistake, I got something wrong, you know, do with me what you will. You know, the whole Ragg situation is more bizarre every time you read the next twist and turn, because we're now hearing that, you know, he was protected when he decided to confess by Jeremy Hunt and others because he was a very key player in the removal of Boris Johnson.
Mm. I think corruption's been very rife within our political systems and in our hierarchies. And I think that's always been there, but I think there was more of a face on it. I think because technology's developed, because ways of investigating have developed, and in a way, transparency has been able... you know, through WhatsApp and other mediums, you know, you can't avoid that transparency. So I think we've sort of cracked open this nest of worms, if you like, and it's revealed what the people in power are really up to. And I think it's always been that way, if I'm honest.
Yeah, but maybe there's more sort of, you know, ability for us all to see it. It's more visible now.
But if you're not teaching children about honour... don't expect them to grow up into honourable adults.
Yes.
You know, if these are not the messages that you are teaching children, and I'm not sure these are the messages that we are teaching children. I think that's, you know, a factual rather than a political statement to say that.
Mm.
I think we have stopped teaching honour and duty as values. And you know, my great theory is that humans need accountability.
Mm.
And once accountability goes, you will just get bad behaviour. That I think the two are inherently connected. So there's more bad behaviour, not because of social media or something else. There's more bad behaviour because structurally we have got rid of accountability.
I wonder as well whether people still look for role models, but they don't find them. So they kind of pick them. for themselves.
And when all that is on television is things like, well, overpaid footballers and Love Island and things like that.
Yeah.
And when we don't have sort of basic good manners anymore, I was reading a piece yesterday about how most 18 to 24, or most 12 to 24-year-olds don't put the elbow, don't care, don't think it matters. Really. Mm. But I don't think young people are even eating at the table anymore. I think they're taking a bowl of something or other to their room, lying on their bed, shoveling food in their mouth, thereby, you know, exacerbating things like obesity and depression and anxiety. I don't think people are sitting around eating at a family table even. They're not even having conversations over food. So I think the whole structure, and, you know, I would blame so much of this down to phones and screens and tablets and internet and the lack of kind of physical interaction with other human beings.
Right. Well, it's interesting you say that.
Staring at a screen or being online for 10 up to 7 to 10 hours a day. Why are we surprised that they can't communicate?
Well, Charlotte Ivers wrote about this at the weekend in the Sunday Times, because there was that other story about how takeaway sort of consumption has now gone up by 50% since last year. People don't go out to restaurants anymore. And she's a restaurant critic for the Sunday Times, amongst other things. And she was like in her local restaurant in North London saying, you know, this local Italian place, it's empty. The only people I'm seeing coming in and out, the guys with the motorbike helmets on, putting it in a moped and taking it around to somebody's house. And the whole idea of actually going to a restaurant, having somebody put some food on a plate for you, talk to you, give you a glass of wine, they're sort of losing the art of it.
I think it's because we're a fairly depressed generation. I think our way of life is depressing, our work is depressing.
See, I don't get any of this.
I do feel that there's a lot of it. You know, everybody feels, it feels very tired at the moment. Sort of everybody's struggling, the cost of living crisis, and yeah, they're spending their money on takeaways, but I think it's easier for a lot of people at the end of a long working day to just sit and order a pizza and be a slob. I think, you know,
See, in my day, we would go out after at the end of a long day and get absolutely pissed and probably laid. And, you know, life wasn't that bad. And sometimes you made mistakes, but you kind of just got on with it.
Yeah.
Well, my theory is that we've got this...
But we weren't particularly unhappy.
No, take me back.
But all my 20s and 30s were happy and drunk and jolly and too much of everything and great fun.
But my working theory is that this comes from what I call the Adena Monsoon generation. You know, there's a generation who did not want to act like adults. They became adults, but they were you know, rebels in their teen years. And now that they're actually in their late 60s, 70s, some cases 80s, they still see themselves as teenage rebels. They refuse to don the mantra of obligation. They refuse to say, I'm an adult, therefore I will control my emotion. I'm an adult, therefore I will comport myself in a certain way. You know, I am an adult, therefore I will be beholden to rules. And you saw that with that nonsense about the Garrick Club.
Oh, yes.
You know, two deeply privileged human beings who their entire professional life have had nothing but accolade after accolade after accolade, who are enjoying, in the case of two of them, you know, noble titles and lots of, certainly enough wealth for them to have a lovely time. And what they want to kick off about is that they're not allowed in a specific club that they want to go in. Right. And they must turn all of national attention to focus on that. All you nation, you plebs, you must care about this. Yeah. Because I say to you, and it's not fair for me.
Yeah, it's a good point.
That's ridiculous behaviour otherwise respectable.
Isn't this a bit double-edged, though? That shouldn't you retain some sort of light and childishness and joyfulness throughout your life? And, you shouldn't always be stiff and controlled. I think you can.
I think there's some truth to that as well.
It can be a bit of both.
I think there are certain childhood aspects of your life that you might want to keep, but petulance and kind of tantruming is not the thing that you should be doing. You can still be wondrous and you can look at the world like a child, look through a child's eyes, but don't lie on the ground and start bashing your feet and your fists against the floor if you don't get what you want.
And I don't think the problem is with the 60, 70-year-olds. I thought we were talking about the younger people and why they're
so... Well, it has a knock-on effect on them.
...depressed and anxious.
I wonder if it's less to be blamed on the older people than it is for the younger people who have been sort of allowed to be indulged so much.
I think so.
Because they've just been given everything.
Yeah, because nothing is ever wrong. Nothing is ever off-limits. Right. Nothing is ever kind of... There are no red lines.
Yeah.
You know, everything is a kind of... I mean, I'm a parent of a very, very young child. You guys, we're all single parents, actually. We were talking about this.
Well, you'll have the next thing on from Gen Z with your son,
which
right?
is Gen who knows what.
What will it be?
But there seems to be no kind of rules. You can't say, no, that's a no. I mean, that's how I parent. Yeah. I am disciplined. I do have boundaries. But in terms of nursery and schools, everything is kind of negotiable. You're meant to be, what's this thing called gentle parenting and all that, and you have to negotiate. You have to explain why they need to put their shoes on. You have to explain why we're leaving the house now.
Right.
Well, I say, no, put your shoes on. Just we need to go out. Yeah. Let's go. Whereas, you know, I think...
Well, this is all
connected. Less power for parents.
Feel that...
Yes, but we must get rules back. I mean, yes. This is... But
you're the
parents, becoming
so, bring the power back.
Children can do so much in the home, but when they go into school and they come back with some fluff that you then have to counteract,
yes.
Yeah. It feels like, you know, the school is the other parent, in a way.
Unbelievable.
This is why people run to courts now. Mm. Courts are becoming substitute parents for people.
And that is another bad thing, is what I'm saying, that, you know, if you go and seek solace with the law in every single situation...
Look at Prince Harry.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, he's never going to stop, is he?
Because for him, pathologically addicted it's to suing people for his unhappy childhood.
Yeah.
Well, like, you know, guess what?
Because it's everybody else's fault.
Of course. It's not the Daily Mail's fault, you know?
No. Probably is the Daily Mail's fault.
A little bit. I mean,
that's what he
most
thinks.
Things are.
That's what he thinks. Well, wait until you see what I've got for you on The World of Woke. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Up next, we're going to talk about Scrabble, because they've managed to make that go woke. Also, we'll have a look at some of the top stories in tomorrow's paper. Stay exactly where you are. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
The World of Woke.
It had to happen, didn't it? You always knew the day would come when competitive games simply would be too much for our little darlings. We've already had the decluttering of school sports to make it easier to look like you didn't lose. After all, it's not about winning, is it? It's about taking part. Only last night we were talking about the lack of resilience amongst our lovely Gen Z fellow travellers. I mean, why should we expect them to want to be ruthless and competitive? That can't be good for the world, can it? Well, now their wish has been granted. No longer will they have to face down the dreaded imagined enemy in anything like a hostile setting. No more will they be forced against their will to stand up for something they're not really sure they believe in. That's right, Scrabble has surrendered. The game that brought hours of fun for all the family during long winter nights and hot summer days has gone over to the other side. The most popular board game in history has had a redesign to make it more inclusive. Now, there's a word to conjure with. Ironically, though, you won't be able to make it a triple word score because why? The new version has outlawed such terrible things in order to make things simpler and to cater for players who find the game too intimidating. They want to make Scrabble Together, which is the new name, easier for people who have less knowledge of the dictionary. Or, to put it another way, people who don't read very much. Mattel says this is the first time in its 75-year history that the game has been shaken up to this extent, and it's already upsetting traditionalists who see Scrabble as a fabulous way to extend and broaden your vocabulary. It's a collaborative and faster-paced version of the iconic word game to make gameplay more accessible for anyone who finds word games intimidating, they say. The new game gives players challenges instead of rewarding them for forming words, and it offers them helper cards if they get stuck. For heaven's sake. Apparently, younger people want to avoid competitive games in a sense of losing. So according to Brett Smitherham, the current UK Scrabble champion, they favour teamwork and working towards a fun goal together. God help us. New research shows that over a third of Britons think baby boomers, of which I'm one, supposedly, are the most competitive generation, followed by millennials, with Gen Z coming in last once again as the least driven. No wonder they can't afford a house. God forbid they ever have to play Cluedo, where someone gets murdered in a stately home, or Snakes and Ladders, or heaven forbid, Monopoly. But that is the World of Woke.
The World of Woke.
Now, I'm going to talk to you about all of that in a minute, the Scrabble scenario, but the panel are back with me. But first of all, we've got to talk about rats, because rats infesting NHS wards, front page of the Metro. I can't believe this story. 18,000 pest cases in 3 years. Cockroaches, flies, maggots, insects biting the legs of staff. I mean, it sounds like... Oh, what's that?
Oh,
there's one in here. For heaven's sake, it's a giant rat. Get rid of it. Where's the rat catcher when you need him? Get lost. Run away. Go on. Shoo. Shoo.
I'm actually being funny.
Get out.
Oh, God.
Oi. Imagine if there was something like that in a hospital.
That is absolutely appalling in a healthcare
setting.
Something
from Albert Camus' The Plague.
It is very similar, isn't it?
It's terrifying.
Oi, ghastly. Anyway, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised. Everything else has gone wrong with the NHS. It's now literally infested with creatures and, you know, nasties and presumably disease-carrying rats, aren't they?
I mean, are there many other kinds? I know you can get field rats and mice that don't carry disease.
I've seen field rats in the countryside, which actually look quite healthy.
But the ones in cities, I think they do carry diseases. Either
like
way,
foxes.
There shouldn't be animals in a hospital setting.
No.
I know it's not necessarily... It's probably the buildings, to be quite honest, the crumbling buildings that need to be rebuilt and need funding. And, you know, the rats have, you know, come in via that way. I don't think it's necessarily always cleanliness. But, you know, food, they're attracted to food, so...
Yeah.
And cockroaches and lice say to me something about food and dirt and things not being very sanitary.
Not very nice. Let's go back to talking about Scrabble. I mean, have you ever heard anything so ridiculous in your life?
I couldn't stop laughing, I'm sorry.
Scrabble is a game which I think loads of us have played over time. It's fun, it's vicious at times, you know. I mean, I always argue with people as to whether or not you can have extended words when you can go round corners and all of that.
Yeah, it often ended up with people kind of throwing the board up and storming
cheating,
out, having a massive
and all of this.
Row.
But this is good for teaching future lawyers. I mean, I always explain to people that a game is a legal system.
Right.
And so that you'll get the statute law in the written rules, but then you have to interpret them.
Right.
You have to have discussions about interpreting them. And if you do your legal system properly,
yes.
you'll consistently apply that interpretation to later events.
Yeah.
Which is what when a family member turns around and says, but last time when it was you got that. And so that is law. So
it's like the Monopoly.
So it's also good for future writers because it's a word game. And if you find word games intimidating, don't play Scrabble.
Right.
Play
or if you find
else.
Losing intimidating, don't play games.
Don't play games at all.
Anything.
Well, don't expect to have a good life, I think.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it's like the Monopoly rules. We play different types of Monopoly rules depending on who you're playing with. You know, do you put the
banker can always cheat.
Yeah, the banker always cheats. And I was always being cheated against by my father and my sister together, who was ganging up on me for some reason.
Yeah.
But I still beat them.
Yeah.
But the point is that, you know, you put all the fine money in the middle, you land on free parking, you keep the money.
Yeah.
Some people don't like that.
No, some people
go round, you're not allowed to buy any property. You know,
buy
all that
up
stuff.
All apart land.
You make up your own rules.
But I will say with this, you know, this is happening a lot. Things are getting reduced in order to be inclusive.
Yeah.
Instead of that, why not take the group that is marginalised and challenge them to improve?
Right.
I know that's not always possible, but I saw a really touching advert about a Down syndrome girl who was challenging her teachers and friends and even the barman. You know, I can drink, I can have sex, I can learn Shakespeare, stop dumbing stuff down for me. So, you know, I don't necessarily think this is a move forward.
Well, look at the Michaela School, you know, where a lot of what you might otherwise call relatively underprivileged kids are having a much better education because they've got structure. And they've got a head teacher who believes in actually disciplining them and saying to them, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You have to come in and you have to concentrate on what you're doing and that's your job.
Yeah.
Well, this is the politics that I will actually do, Mike. I allow myself to do social mobility politics in public. For 13 years, I've volunteered in social mobility. I've built my own charity.
I've seen you doing that.
These young people can achieve things.
Of course they can.
You know, I've taken a bunch of kids from disadvantaged backgrounds in East London. They've studied over 13 weeks, and then they've presented in the House of Commons intelligently on corporate insolvency law.
Right.
Okay, they can do that. And I think you do challenge young people, you challenge children, and you will get better results.
Yeah.
The idea that people are incapable, as you say, it is that bigotry of low expectations.
And it's also a very middle-class thing, right? And I don't want to keep saying that it's from the left, but it is quite often from the left, where they want to protect people and they want to give them a special status and say, well, you mustn't say that about them.
But then
let them run free.
It's like slapping trigger warnings on everything. But yesterday in the playground, my three-year-old, there was a little child in the corner of the playground in a wheelchair. My little three-year-old grabbed the wheelchair, span him round and put him on the roundabout. The kid and my kid were having so much fun.
Yeah.
He didn't think, he's in a wheelchair, he can't do it, he's going to sit in the corner of the playground feeling lonely. He just thought, let's have fun together. Let me spin this wheelchair around.
Oh,
they loved it. And that's so much more fun for both of them than saying, you know, let's protect him. Let's keep him safe.
And so much more fun than sitting there on the phone, because I've got some good news for you. The Telegraph has got a story about Michelle Donlan looking at imposing a restriction on phones being sold to young people under the age of 16.
Absolutely.
I know this has been one of your bugbears for a while.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted that everybody is now catching up, and actually sales and the interest from the big phone companies, not from my campaign, the interest from the big phone companies is being driven by this. They're starting to look at developing what they call dumb phones. I would call them brick phones.
Yeah, yeah.
Phones where, yes, children can
still
be contactable.
You can actually just use it to phone people.
Yeah, to say to your mum, I've missed the bus or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's more interest, and apparently there's more interest from young people themselves as well.
Hmm.
This has only been in the last few months, actually, that we're seeing a lot more interest. And I think once people start buying them, once parents start saying, actually, look at how toxic this stuff is, I don't see, Mike, I know I've said this before, I don't see anything positive. I really don't about young people being on the internet. They've got their whole lives.
Yeah.
That we're all addicted to this stuff. They've got their whole lives ahead of them,
yeah.
staring at their phones, staring at tablets the way we do all day long. Yeah. Let them have a childhood. Let them be outside. Yeah.
But I think the only thing I would say about that is, you know, under 16, possibly a bit too old, really.
Yeah, maybe look, under, I know. Maybe I'm going to hold 12. Back the tide.
I think 13 or 12 at high school age.
I think secondary school, yeah. I've always said this to you as well, you know, incorporate the internet and incorporate maybe phones even into secondary
school.
Bit of
school. Education yeah. about it.
You know,
though.
Let them know that, because you don't want to make it a forbidden fruit.
No,
either.
Exactly.
Yeah, but there was a brilliant study on Radio 4 about how young girls in particular were over-suffering because they download social media.
Mm.
And one of the things that was protecting young boys is that they don't download a competitive game.
Right.
So if we take them away from competitive gaming...
And porn.
Well, but if you take them away from competitive gaming, then they'll just be on social media being bullied as well.
Right.
So Scrabble, could you not kill competitive gaming?
Yes.
Actually, we need it to protect the mental health of our kids.
I mean, in fairness to Scrabble, they are keeping the original Scrabble, but they've just come up with this other one, which completely... It
would be interesting to see the sales of that game
in the
coming months
if
it actually flies off the
shelves.
Also,
if you've got a kind of any sense of competitive spirit anyway, it doesn't matter how mealy-mouthed the game is, you're going to want to win it, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I've hoped...
I can get competitive about snakes and ladders.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it.
I'm competitive about absolutely everything.
Yeah.
You know, but according to, the studies, that's because I'm a baby boomer. And I don't know whether it is, but it's just that was the way we were raised.
I think most kids, young people, people of all ages with any kind of chutzpah want to win. They want to be the best. Yeah. Not in a kind of violent way, but just saying it's great. When you're running,
sucks.
You want to be the fastest.
You know, exactly right. And if you can't be the fastest, you just trip the other people up.
Yeah. Or just like, I'm not interested in this, and walk off.
Maori King declares Wales a people in push for legal rights. I'm not even sure we've got time to discuss this, but, I mean, what a weird story that is.
It's weird, but I think it's a really nice sentiment. I think whales are beautiful creatures.
They are.
And I think they should be protected more. And being seen as a delicacy in certain countries, I think that's just disgraceful.
I don't think I'd ever eat a whale.
I had the option to once and declined. Yeah. I was in Japan and I just said, no, I can't. I can't do it.
I wasn't expecting that story to go that way, but I don't want to eat them. I just don't want to give them rights to drive down the road
No, that's the difference.
You know,
they're not
lane for them.
They're not people. I mean, we can protect them, but whales are not people, and
listen,
people are not whales.
We've had too many animals on this show already. We got rid of the rat. Oh, he's coming back. There he is. He's over there. That's all from me tonight. You've been watching The Independent Republic, Mike Graham. Thank you very much to everybody who came. The panel were brilliant. I'll see you tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. It's only on Talk TV. Good night.